Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas Program at CSIS, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this presentation by His Excellency Antonio Patriota, Ambassador of Brazil. Brazil's been very much in the news recently for good reason, with President Bush's visit to the region and President Lula's visit to Washington, D.C., and much talk of very interesting and promising cooperation between our two countries on energy and many other issues. It's a very appropriate moment for Ambassador Patriota to discuss the topic of the outlook for Brazil's foreign policy and Brazil-U.S. relations. Ambassador Patriota is a very distinguished career diplomat who has served his country at the United Nations in embassies in Beijing and Caracas, very important embassies for Brazil, has been deputy permanent representative to the World Trade Organization, chief of staff to the Minister of Foreign Relations, and was Undersecretary General for Political Affairs at the Ministry of Foreign Relations before taking up his position here in Washington. I noticed in the ambassador's curriculum that he and I share a very interesting coincidence. He's lived many years in Geneva, as have I, except in my case it was Geneva, Illinois. But anyway, it's a great pleasure, a great honor for the Americas Program at CSIS to welcome Ambassador Patriota, who has very generously agreed to take questions from the audience after his presentation. Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you very much for your introduction, Ambassador DeShazo. And I see some familiar faces here, Joanna Foreman Mendelson, whom I've known for many years, and others. It's a pleasure to spend some time with you and speak a little bit about Brazil's foreign policy and Brazil's relationship with the United States that is, I think, experiencing a moment of, according to one description, a moment of strategic opportunity. And I think that's a very good expression that was used by an American official from the National Security Council. I think it's also a great moment for Brazilian diplomacy more generally, and maybe I'll start from there. A few days ago, we celebrated the Day of the Diplomat, which is an important day for all of us career diplomats in the Brazilian Foreign Service. It's a day when usually the President of the Republic comes to the Foreign Ministry and makes a speech on foreign policy. And this year was no different. President Lula came to Itamaraty, as our foreign ministry is known. He made a long speech, having just been reelected last year in October with, I think, a very significant voting turnout and majority. He was in, I think, the interesting position of being able to speak of the accomplishments of the past 4 years, or unquestionably the Brazilian foreign policy was a very active, very innovative one, very creative one, and also to set some guidelines for the future. In fact, we're translating the speech so it will be in our embassy's website, and I think it will be very interesting for everyone with a particular interest in Brazil for future reference. I may start on a light note saying that we are very proud that today the heads of all Brazilian embassies abroad are career diplomats. So when I speak of a good moment for Brazilian diplomats, I mean it in a very literal way. This has not always been the case, although in our system, we have always had a majority of career diplomats heading Brazilian embassies abroad. But I think it also reflects an enthusiasm on the part of President Lula himself for an establishment, in the case of the Foreign Ministry in Brazil, that has, I think it's fair to say, without sounding too self-congratulatory, distinguished itself as a very professional body within the state apparatus in Brazil. So this is probably the first time I don't know if in history, but in recent memory, that all Brazilian ambassadors abroad are career diplomats. No single political appointee. There were two political appointees in the first Lula government. They've been replaced by career diplomats. Basically, when Lula addressed the audience of young diplomats just having graduated last week, he reiterated the central orientation of the foreign policy as it has been implemented over the past 4 years, with a very central position for our relationship with our neighbors in South America. South American integration has become the number one priority for the foreign policy. It's interesting to see that in my context here in Washington, where I've arrived since about 2 months, I note that not everyone is as familiar as we are in Brazil and in South America, I believe, with the new dynamics in the interaction between the countries that compose South America in terms of the regularity of meetings, the very frequent contacts at all levels, whether it is heads of state, foreign ministers, second, third tier officials in different ministries. The private sector is more is interacting more. We have yet to promote the kind of people-to-people contact we'd like to see, but it is increasing greatly. I think to a point where the only other region that I see, and there is one other region where this type of dynamics is even more advanced than us, but the only other example would be really the European Union, because what you see today are heads of state calling each other and saying, I'm going to pass by and have dinner, and maybe I'll take someone else on the plane, and we'll gather to discuss some important infrastructure project or some energy issue or something of that nature. And this is deserves to be highlighted in itself, because for a long time this was not at all the case. In fact, we lived rather back-to-back towards our neighbors. We assume a measure of responsibility for this, notwithstanding the very serious efforts that have been made, in particular since Mercosul became a building block for integration. So when one speaks of South American integration, there's no doubt that the main inputs for that are, first of all, solid relationship with Argentina, being the second economy in South America, and a partner with which we have not always seen as eye-to-eye as we do today. Really, the relationship experiencing today a very, very positive and harmonious moment in terms of economic agenda, political agenda, the emphasis on social development, really the whole range of issues that characterize the relationship between two states. And this is fundamental for holding together Mercosul. That is a common market, as you know, faces its own challenges. This is something that we recognize and acknowledge in part due to its very structure, where you have two larger countries and up until very recently, until Venezuela became a part, two very small economies with small territory and population. So a structurally asymmetrical group, much more so, for example, than the initial European grouping that promoted European integration. Notwithstanding, there has been progress in the recognition of this asymmetry on the part of the two larger partners, Brazil and Argentina. And I think this is providing the necessary cement for Mercosul to go more deeply into integration. And when we speak of integration within Mercosul in South America, again, I think the European model is one that comes to mind, because one is thinking of within the medium term or the foreseeable future, not only the abolition of trade barriers, but perhaps common policy, common industrial policy, common agricultural policy, the free flow of people. And there have been important advances on that front. For example, probably not too many of you know that one doesn't need passports anymore to travel between South American countries, with two exceptions, two of the South American members that asked for some more time to implement this decision. And, of course, the whole question of infrastructure, which remains very much at the forefront of the integration agenda, infrastructure here meaning transport, energy, communications in particular. I would also mention that although it does not come out as visibly as the economic agenda, there is also something to be said about the fact that integration can, and I think ideally will, help to deepen our democratic roots in South America. I think South America deserves to be recalled also, is probably unique among the regions of the developing world for being composed of countries that are all governed by democratically elected leaders. Not only that, but all of them today, I think, share a common concern with the very serious challenges posed by inequality in our part of the world, which has been a defining characteristic of Latin America, but very particularly of Brazil and of South America. So the social agenda is, of course, very present in all these governments. But we see, and again, perhaps the European parallel can serve as an inspiration, but we see integration, certainly in Brazil, also as a vehicle for institutional development and for democratic enhancement, if I can put it that way. Granted that perhaps not all countries are at the exact same level of political development, the same happens in other democratic regions of the world, but the expectation is that through an exchange of experiences, through greater contacts among countries of that face similar social challenges and political challenges, democracy will take root. Well, having spoken a little bit about South American integration, which remains very much at the center of our preoccupations, and again, taking the lead from President Lula last week's speech, he spoke of the many new initiatives that have taken place in terms of Brazil establishing closer links with other regions of the developing world. Now, perhaps I should say this before anyone gets the wrong idea, and it's also a point that he made and that I have been making here in Washington very consistently, that these initiatives that focus on the developing world are not at the expense of our ties with traditional partners like the United States, Europe, Japan. Very much on the contrary. And I think it'll be interesting to perhaps reach a partial conclusion at some point in our discussion today that it may be at least in part due to this very active international agenda globally that Brazil has developed that some of our developed country partners have been paying more attention to Brazilian diplomacy. Certainly, the leadership that Brazil has exercised at WTO, for example, by forging a group of like-minded developing countries with common interests in, on the agricultural front, initially seen with some distrust by the United States, by the European Union, but today I think broadly accepted as a constructive force for promoting consensus and a constructive force for advancing the Doha round of trade negotiations. So, of course, the agendas are interlinked. The one that gives special attention to new ties with the developing world, in addition to the ties that we have already forged in our through our history, and today, perhaps with a renewed packaging, are forging with capitals such as Washington, Brussels, and others. But going back to the developing world, Africa has figured quite prominently in Brazil's international foreign policy under, I think, what could be described as a new spirit. I'm not sure all of you know that President Lula was the first to create a ministry in Brazil to deal with the question of racial inequality, a ministry to reduce racial inequality. And he often, in his speeches, establishes a linkage between a renewed interest in Africa and our own challenges internally in confronting the legacy of slavery and the fact that although we take great pride in what others consider as a racial democracy, there is still much progress to be made in terms of promoting better standards of living for the African descendants in Brazil, who are often at the bottom of the social scale in indicators such as education, income, and others. So looking to Africa to value this historical heritage and to establish new linkages, this has been, I think, a very rewarding experience in not only in economic terms, where trade has increased considerably. I have some figures. I believe that trade with Africa has doubled over the past 4 years. In the case of some countries, the increase has even been more expressive. South Africa, for example, of the 24 new embassies that Brazil has opened around the world, a large part of those are in Africa. Brasilia has become the capital in Latin America with the largest number of African embassies. This was not always the case until very recently. Havana was the capital in the Americas with the largest number of African embassies. So you can see that there's a new pattern emerging here, and one that is opening new opportunities for economic and political dialogue. We opened an embassy in Addis Abeba. I know the United States has just done that also, to create new possibilities for interacting with the African Union Secretariat in the Ethiopian capital. The president is always very proud to announce that he is the Brazilian head of state who has made the most numerous trips to the African continent, and including there, of course, Sub-Saharan and Northern Africa. Another of the more innovative coalitions that we've established, to put it that way, has been the IBSA Forum, which unites India, Brazil, and South Africa. And the idea here being that these three countries, being three large democracies in South America, Africa, and South Asia, have a special responsibility in coordinating on matters of common interest, from the political agenda, even defense matters, to trade, economics, investment, and others, in as much as if they don't come together, it will be very difficult for the neighboring countries, the smaller countries, to interact in a productive way. So it's been interesting to see how through these new ties that are being forged between Pretoria, Brasilia, and New Delhi, you create, in fact, synergies that can also benefit the regional countries. You bring together Mercosul and SADC, and as well as other countries in Asia. One aspect of this interrelationship is, for example, transport, where historically we've had to travel to Europe to go to South Africa or to India, and today you have better possibilities for going from a city in South America to South Asia through Africa, and I know that the same is happening with the maritime links, for example. You have probably heard of the BRICS acronym that was not created by any of the governments involved. In fact, it was Goldman Sachs here in the United States that first put out a report mentioning Brazil, Russia, India, and China as dynamic economies that would be among the world's six largest economies by mid-century. But this has also prompted the respective governments to start coordinating. And this year, there will be there's been a short organizational meeting among the foreign ministers of the four countries, but there will be a full-fledged ministerial encounter between the men in charge of foreign policy in Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which also is perhaps a new coalition and a new grouping for looking at possibilities for cooperation. Two other interesting initiatives that have, had a symbolic value in themselves, but also established a timetable for continuing interaction between regions of the developing world have been the South America League of Arab States Members Summit, or Middle East South America Summit, in May 2005, met in Brasilia. And there will be another one in Morocco next year, if I'm not mistaken. This has provided a forum for discussions on cooperation ranging from culture, education, economics, trade, etc., between two regions that have, in fact, similar challenges on many fronts. Important also to realize that in South America, for example, there's no country where you will not find an expressive community of Syrian or Lebanese or Palestinian origin. In Brazil alone, there are 8 million citizens of Lebanese descent. So in many ways, this is a re-encounter with the roots for many of the people in South America, not to mention of the influence that the Iberian Peninsula, of course, received from the Arab world, and the cooperation that is, of course, I think should be highlighted and stressed, turned to exclusively towards peaceful cooperation. A similar summit was organized between South America and Africa. It goes by the acronym of AFRAS. You have several new acronyms. You have ASPA for América do Sul, Oriente Médio, so this is the Middle East, South America, and you have AFRAS for South America and Africa. Similarly, it was held in Abuja, Nigeria last year. There will be another one in South America in 2 years, I believe. And here again, you open up possibilities for interaction between countries of similar level of development and that often can provide, through their experience, ideas or possible solutions for challenges in other parts of the developing world. As I said, when I interjected a parenthesis during my presentation, this has taken place without detriment to the attention that we have paid and intend to continue to pay and in fact, trying to, in many situations, give a new format or interject new dynamics into this to our relationship with traditional partners. Since I'm going to end with the United States, I may speak of some of the other traditional partners. Japan, a very important partner. As you know, also Brazil has the largest community of Japanese immigrants outside Japan. More than 1 million Brazilians trace their ascendants to Japanese immigrants. A very important trading partner. And now also, since more recently, a partner on the biofuels front. This is not something that came about spontaneously. It took considerable political investment and energy to reach a point where members of, well, Petrobras and I think Mitsui is the company in Japan, reached an agreement, which happened last year. But we feel that this will open up new avenues for cooperation with Japan, a country with which we have had traditional ties. Next year, 2008, we celebrate 100 years of the Japanese immigration to Brazil. With the European Union, ties have also been traditionally close, but this year we will witness an important development to the extent that Brazil will be considered a strategic partner of the European Union. So President Lula will be going to a summit meeting in Brussels by mid-year. This status of strategic partners involves closer dialogue on political issues, the entire international political agenda, but it should also promote more investment, more trade. Of course, as you know, we are negotiating a bilateral agreement, an inter-regional agreement between Mercosur and the European Union. The discussions have not always proceeded in a linear fashion, given difficulties that perhaps are better reconciled in the WTO discussions regarding agricultural trade. But nevertheless, it has provided a forum for, I think, very constructive discussion on the whole range of trade issues between the two regions. And we are confident that these will produce a favorable outcome in the very near future. Well, turning then finally to the United States, and again referring to this expression that I heard of strategic opportunity, indeed, I think we are witnessing an extremely promising moment in the relationship between the two countries, and I can think of at least three areas of strategic importance where there has been a convergence. And these are areas that have to do with regional stability, with the world economy, and also with the environment and energy security, which is the biofuels front. Interesting, because although this is all happening at the same time, it could have been differently, and it has been different in the past. Well, to start off with the regional issue, which is the Haiti situation. As you know, today Brazil is leading the United Nations mission on stabilization in Haiti in terms of its military command. This was an initiative that did not come spontaneously within the Brazilian political context either, because there was quite a bit of opposition in our Congress for Brazil to take up such an initiative, given our own challenges and so the urban violence that we still have to deal with in large Brazilian cities. But notwithstanding, it was possible to obtain congressional approval for this deployment. And interestingly, I think 2 years after the initial deployment, you could today affirm that we are very close to a national consensus on the positive results that this initiative has had, not only for Haiti, but even in terms of the experience gained by our own forces. So it's really become a win-win situation, I would say, internally for Brazil, but also an issue for convergence with the United States. And it may be interesting to note that even as recently as the mid-90s, when there was a first Haitian crisis that led Haiti to be included in the agenda of the Security Council, the United Nations Security Council, we did not necessarily see eye to eye with the United States at that time. In fact, we voted differently on the authorization for a first multinational force, Brazil having abstained and the United States, of course, having been behind that initiative. So I think quite important to note that on this single item in the Americas that is included in the agenda of the UN Security Council, Brazil and the United States today cooperate very constructively. In fact, I just came from a meeting at the State Department with the Undersecretary Burns, and once again, we compared notes on Haiti, and our agendas are basically very, very similar and entirely compatible. A second front is the multilateral trading system front. Here again, if one looks even as recently as the Cancun Ministerial Conference in 2003, when Brazil, together with India, South Africa, Argentina, I think those are really the core of the emerging G20 group of developing countries, rejected certain proposals on agriculture, thereby producing a certain impact in the discussions. Well, those countries were blamed at the time for creating obstacles to an agreement within WTO. And today what we see is that the same group of countries actually being incorporated into the nucleus, the negotiating nucleus of the exercise with a new G4, which includes, in addition to India and Brazil, the United States and the European Union. And as I mentioned, the G20 platforms being seen, I think, very broadly, including by the facilitators for the negotiations on agriculture, Chairman Crawford Falconer from New Zealand, as a middle ground that provides possibly a way forward for us to reach a successful outcome for the Doha negotiation at WTO. So here again, a very favorable moment. In fact, when Minister Celso Morin meets with USTR Susan Schwab, they often highlight the fact that even within the G4 countries, Brazil and the U.S. Can be said to share a particular affinity in the sense that they define their objectives within the Doha round as ambitious objectives for market access, of course, I think in the case of the United States, but ambitious nonetheless. And finally, I think the third issue of convergence between the two countries, that again of importance bilaterally, but also regionally and globally, is the energy and the biofuels agenda. As you know, an MOU was signed in Sao Paulo when President Bush visited Brazil last March. That really included three levels of cooperation. First level, a bilateral front, and we were just discussing at the State Department some steps that will be taken very soon for greater interaction between Brazilian experts and scientists and U.S. Institutions of excellence in research and development of biofuels, particularly on the cellulosic front. So we hope that this will very soon be translated into concrete results. Similar groups will be traveling from the U.S. to Brazil, perhaps Brazil more advanced in terms of the networks for distribution of ethanol, the productivity, research, and sugarcane being, as you know, a much more effective food stock for producing biofuels than corn, which is the staple in this country. As well as on the transportation front with the flex fuel cars in Brazil, today 40% of the fleet of vehicles circulating in Brazil are flex fuel, meaning they can run entirely on ethanol or gas or any mixture thereof, and 80% of the new cars are flex fuel. So here perhaps an area where there is something for the U.S. To examine and to observe and to perhaps learn from our experience. But there is also the regional front where the U.S. and Brazil have decided to work together in developing pilot projects in countries such as Haiti, Dominican Republic, El Salvador, St. Kitts and Nevis. These are initial beneficiaries of this cooperation. In the future, we would like to have more in-depth discussions with the Central American Integration System, as well as with CARICOM. In fact, diplomats from Brazil and the United States are traveling tomorrow for a meeting in Belize City, to establish contacts with the Central Americans and the Caribbean nations so that we can have a more sub-regional approach and understand where this cooperation can be more effective. In any event, these four initial countries seem to be very excited about the prospects of cooperating with Brazil and the U.S., and we can also identify in the private sector in Brazil, for example, enthusiasm for these possibilities. The Brazilian companies are already present in El Salvador. They are starting to establish contacts with Dominican Republic and Haiti on the ethanol producing front as well. Those two countries being, of course, potentially big sugarcane producers. And in St. Kitts, a very small economy, the idea is perhaps to assist the local government in producing energy from sugarcane bagasse and thereby helping them to save in their energy bill. And the possibilities seem to be ones of that will have great impact for their small scale, but for them, of course, fundamental energy sector. And then, let's say, more in a more plurilateral world level or multilateral level, there has been a cooperation that started last year involving not only Brazil, the United States, but also the Europeans, China, India, and South Africa, in terms of having discussions to promote biofuels and ethanol in particular as a world commodity. For this to happen, one needs to establish common standards for the product or at least try to work towards compatibilization. I don't know if that word exists in English. It does in Portuguese, so you will excuse me for inventing a word, but making the different types of ethanol compatible among themselves, and perhaps in the future this will lead to a world conference uniting a larger number of partners from across the world that Brazil would be happy to host, and to establish new avenues for cooperation in the promotion of biofuels. Now, in addition to these areas of strategic importance, if I may say, the more traditional bilateral agenda with the United States, I think, is moving ahead as well. If one looks at the trade and investment front, for example, a new initiative has just been agreed upon at Camp David when President Lula visited the U.S. on March the 31st, namely the establishment of CEO Forum, a forum of high-level, high-profile businessmen from companies with a clear interest in the bilateral relationship who will meet together with government representatives on both sides. I think on the American side it will be Mr. Al Hubbard, who was senior economist at the White House. On the Brazilian side, President Lula's chief of staff, Dilma Rousseff, and perhaps the Minister for Trade and Industry as well. So this will ensure that the discussions between the two private sectors is also one that benefits from governmental input at the highest level. The only other such forum existing today from the U.S. perspective is the U.S.-India forum. So this will be we will be benefiting perhaps from the lessons learned from the U.S.-India experience, and we're very excited about putting this on track, possibly May or June. In May, we will be advancing on the organizational front, but perhaps in June we can have the first meeting of the forum. Of course, we are waiting eagerly to see in the case of the United States, a procedure was established whereby candidates present their candidacies to sit on the forum, which will be a small mechanism of maybe 6 to 8 people on each side. In the case of the Brazilian side, the CEOs have already been identified. There are other initiatives that have been decided to boost the economic and trade relationship. For example, an instruction from the two leaders for a double taxation agreement, for efforts towards reaching agreement on a double taxation agreement to be intensified in the coming weeks and months. And this is something that comes in response to very explicit interest, not only on the U.S. side, but also in the increasing numbers of Brazilian investors in the United States. And this is a new feature in the relationship that is quite interesting. I just came back from Miami, where I met with representatives of Embraer, the Brazilian aircraft producers, Odebrecht, a big civil construction company from Bahia in Brazil that is very present in Florida. In fact, has been building airports in the United States. Perhaps not too many people know that. TAM Airlines, Gerdau, Steelworks, others, totaling, I think, close to $5 billion in Brazilian investment in the U.S. So all of these very interested in the double taxation, in the double taxation agreement. So I think this illustrates a moment of really in new and interesting possibilities. Let me perhaps conclude with two comments, really, or two lines of thinking. First of all, this is happening at a moment where I think the Brazilian economy itself is going through a very positive phase. Not something that has been obvious for the past few decades, where we struggled with galloping inflation, a serious debt crisis, recurring debt crisis, limited reserves, following an initial phase in the post-war period of high economic growth, also years of very slow economic growth. Today, you have an entirely different picture with what may be described as sustainable growth for the economy. With the revised figures for the Brazilian economy, it has now it's possible to say that we've been growing at, on average, 4% a year for the past 4 years. The the IMF forecast for this year is 4.4%, which may seem relatively low compared to some of the very fast Asian economies. But again, if one looks at the BRICS report, it's interesting to refer back to that report once in a while. It had forecast that the Brazilian economy would not grow as fast as India and China for structural reasons. The workforce in Brazil haven't been assimilated into the mainstream economy during the first decades after World War II, and so a similar process that is now taking place in India and China having already occurred in Brazil. And in the BRICS report, it says that even growing at 3.6% a year, Brazil would still be among the six largest economies by the mid-century. So I'm only referring to people who are more knowledgeable than myself on this front. But if one looks at other indicators, generation of employment, more than 1 million jobs created each year, international reserves today, $120 billion at last count. The president of the central bank was here last week, so I'm quoting from our foremost monetary authority. Again, this is something that helps to create the necessary stability, and very soon, I think the expectation is that Brazil will reach investment grade status. There were some discussions recently when Minister Guido Mantega was here during the IMF World Bank spring meeting. Trade, of course, being another engine for growth and going through a phase of extraordinary dynamism, I would say, whether one looks at bilateral trade with the U.S., which has grown considerably, the U.S. still being our single main trading partner, but also with many of these new markets around the world, to the point where today, in a situation with trade with the United States, Europe, and Japan has continued to grow significantly, we have reached a point where trade with developing countries is actually more than 50% of our trade, which was not the case 4 years ago. But I would add that also on the political front, Brazil today is going through a moment of development and institutional development and great vigor in our democracy. I was very happy to host here about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, a number of new governors who were visiting Washington and New York. I think there were 7 or 8 of them. Among the newly elected governors, majority of them are in their 40s, some in their early 40s. And this, I think, is very important, very symbolic of this democratic renewal. These are all politicians with very strong democratic credentials, politicians that bring, I think, a modern outlook to business and to governance in their, at the state level, and that demonstrate that the Brazilian political class is renewing itself in a way that, well, one doesn't necessarily see in all parts of the world. And I can recall Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, for example, commenting in with some degree of frustration to Minister Amorim recently that, for example, she thought that in the Middle East there was a deficit precisely in terms of the renewal of the leadership. And this in a context where we have managed to overcome some delicate political situations, but with full respect for institutions and a really vibrant Congress, freedom of the press, and perhaps a model of, let's say, left of center government that has, I think, proven to be quite an inspiration for other parts of our region and maybe even beyond our region, but maybe that is for other observers of the Brazilian reality to say rather than for myself. I might conclude just by saying that it's really an extraordinary moment to be Brazilian ambassador to the United States, given all the possibilities that are opening for the relationship, and also, I think, as a function of what I see as a very vibrant foreign policy from the part of Brazil, and also good economic indicators and a very good moment politically. So thank you very much.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for your very interesting presentation. The floor is open to questions. If you would please raise your hand, identify yourself, and your affiliation before you make your question. Sir?
I'm Harry Inman, Inter-American Bar Association. What steps are being taken to deter
the violence in the cities?
Well, first of all, I think it's might be interesting to note that violence in the cities is something that does not happen in every major Brazilian city. And in fact, there's a curious phenomenon today that the worst violence is occurring in Rio and São Paulo, which are comparatively more wealthier cities. You know? There are parts of Brazil that are more developed. So although I'm not a specialist in urban violence, I have read a book recently by a French author called Emmanuel Todd, well, of English origin, who points to the fact that violence and urban violence, or even some manifestations of terrorism, and perhaps we should distinguish that Brazil is blessed by an absence of terrorism, is very often not a result of extreme poverty, but rather a result of the awareness of inequality. And it often comes at a stage of development where the less favored segments of society become more acutely aware that, you know, there is incredible wealth right next to them. And I think this is a good explanation of why it occurs on such a large scale in Rio and São Paulo, Rio being a city where anybody who has been there can see that the contrast between the wealthier and the less favored segments of society. Now, what is being done? I know that there is now an effort, and this involves the new governors that have taken office. New efforts are underway for greater coordination between the states where violence is the most serious, meaning Rio, São Paulo, Espírito Santo, Minas, the south, east. May seem something simple, but not obvious, because in the past, political differences prevented this from happening, and political attitudes on a part of these governors that I think one could consider short-sighted, in fact, prevented this. Another effort that is taking place, and I think here we can learn something from our neighbors. Colombia has had very, very good results in fighting urban violence. I know that Sergio Cabral, the governor of Rio, was in Medellin, and he was studying the measures that were taken in Colombia. So I think really a new effort to see what are policies at work. Of course, this is inextricably linked to the social agenda, the need for social policies that will afford employment, education, better opportunity for the young. And this is something President Lula is very frequently speaking about. In fact, when he announced a new program for education this year, he mentioned the spin-offs that were expected in reduced levels of violence. Part of it is just repression that has to be more effective. So some of the leaders involved, the governor of Rio in particular, has asked for federal assistance in combating crime in the streets of Rio. And this, again, is something that has required some enlightened political leadership. Without wanting to name any former governors of Rio, I think this had been lacking in recent past. So I would say the outlook is really much more favorable today for tackling this on a serious basis.
Jeff Hornbeck with the Congressional Research Service. I was wondering, from your perspective, whether these growing bilateral sectoral initiatives in the trade front between Brazil and the United States, are they effectively replacing any idea of moving ahead with an FTAA down the road, or is that still an idea that whose time
No.
may eventually come?
No. The answer is this is not seen as a replacement for a possible agreement. In fact, when Minister Celso Marinho was here late March, interestingly, these discussions started at the State Department rather than at the USTR, Department of Commerce. But one of the issues on the agenda was precisely how to enhance the trade and economic relationship between the two countries. So one of my tasks to follow up on those discussions will be to develop what we are calling a structured dialogue that will look at sectors where there is an obvious interest for enhanced cooperation. And, well, on that occasion, I think it's perfectly acceptable to mention here, not a confidential piece of information, the notion that this might eventually lead to a Mercosur-US agreement, for example, was mentioned, although not seen as an immediate objective because, of course, the two countries are now investing greatly in the success of the Doha round. There are constraints, I think, even within the United States that may not favor taking up such a negotiating exercise right now, as we see the challenges for some of the bilaterals that were negotiated with Peru, Colombia, Panama, to be passed by the U.S. Congress. But I would answer in the affirmative to the second part of your question. Yes, it is on the agenda, and no, biofuels is not a substitute for that. The MOU.
Thanks, Mr. Ambassador. Andrew Redman from the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. I wanted to follow up on the comments you made about cooperative R&D efforts in the biofuels area. And I wondered if you could comment on how you reconcile the desire to encourage joint R&D in innovative and technological fields with the recent decision to issue a compulsory license for a pharmaceutical product and thereby break a valid patent.
Well, first of all, I think it's necessary to recognize, and I don't think anybody disputes this in the United States, that the measures recently taken in Brazil are perfectly in conformity with international commitments and international law. So this is something that is foreseen in the TRIPS agreement, WTO, and that was very high in the agenda at the Doha ministerial. I was at Doha myself, and I participated in the negotiation of the declaration on TRIPS and public health, and it was obvious to anyone who participated in that exercise that the challenge there was to reconcile protection for patents with the humanitarian imperative of dealing with health emergencies and health challenges anywhere in the world. In fact, this doesn't have to do necessarily with level of development. We know that Italy and Canada have resorted to compulsory licensing. The U.S. considered resorting to it when there was the anthrax scare or panic a few years ago. So it's a valid international instrument at the disposal of governments when faced with a specific challenge. I think that in part answers the rest of the question. If this instrument exists, it's to be used, of course, with necessary care. In this instance, to the extent that I was informed of the procedure, a genuine effort was made to negotiate an agreed settlement with the company in question. So there were several rounds of negotiations and ongoing discussions for 6 months. So this should be seen within its own context, and I don't think that it affects broader desire to, in fact, cooperate with any country, in fact, on the research and development front. There are many pharmaceutical companies established in Brazil. Recently, I was speaking to a representative of GlaxoSmithKline, for example, who have a very ambitious program with Manguinhos, the Center of Excellence in Rio for biology and development of medicines. So I'm sure that this will go on.
I'm Jeff Schott with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Brief comment and a brief question. The comment is, I think you have put a very nice gloss on Brazil's economic performance, which most people would characterize as stodgy, given the fact that you have had wonderful conditions with high commodity prices and have yet not been able to move out of a rather modest pace of economic growth needed to spur the social programs that the Lula government has been trying to pursue during its term in office. That puts attention on the importance of pursuing these international initiatives to spur innovation and productivity in the Brazilian economy, as you just mentioned. and I applaud the new initiatives, but wonder how the international trade initiatives would proceed between the United States and Mercosul when Mercosul is now encumbered, perhaps is the best word, by the membership of Venezuela. That would seem to make it much more difficult to move in the economic areas internationally where Brazil could proceed much more quickly bilaterally. And I wondered if there is some flexibility in Brazil's policy that would enable that to happen on a sort of separate or parallel tracks.
Well, first of all, the Brazilian economic performance, I think I could refer to statements by the head of the IMF, for example, Rodrigo de Rato, who very recently during the spring meeting described it in very enthusiastic terms. Maybe you have to look at Brazil in its own context and see where we are coming from compared to the situation in the 80s and even the 90s. Today's situation is a very, very favorable one. Of course, it could always be better, and we will certainly be working to improve the situation, including through partnerships with other countries. So the fact that Brazil is multiplying its contacts with partners across the world and developing new partnerships is, I think, something also which is very much done in a spirit of accelerating growth. Maybe I should have mentioned the program for accelerated growth that was announced at the beginning of the year and which will involve, I think, close to $250 billion in investments for dealing with some of the bottlenecks that we do face in terms of transportation, seaports, roads, etc., and trying to attract private investment to this effort in a public-private partnership. So, of course, the situation could be much better, but I think given the recent evolution, it is quite worthy of manifestation of some satisfaction, at least. In terms of the Venezuelan situation, I think it might be interesting to note that Venezuela is the second largest U.S. partner in Latin America, trade-wise, ahead of Brazil. And it has been a growing market for U.S. exports at a more accelerated pace than U.S. exports have grown to Brazil. And they have grown considerably to Brazil as well. So maybe that speaks for itself. I don't know. Your question may be perhaps better directed to a U.S. government official. What I can say from the Brazilian perspective is that there is a strategic value ascribed to the fact that Venezuela today is interested in regional integration. Because historically, Venezuela was a country, well, with great oil wealth and very interested in export markets and that really looked more to the developed world for economic cooperation. Today, we see Venezuela very committed to South American integration, to having discussions, not always, of course, discussions that don't necessarily proceed on the basis of an automatic consensus. There are different views on many of the points being discussed. But, for example, the recent summit organized at Isla Margarita on energy was one of great importance for South America, to the extent that I think it helped to dissipate some of the misperceptions, including about the MOU signed between Brazil and the U.S. on biofuels, on the role that biofuels may play in our energy matrix in the region, but also brought out the fact that South America is potentially an energy powerhouse in a region of the world that could be self-sufficient in energy, given the oil reserves, gas reserves, the possibilities for producing ethanol, the nuclear know-how developed in Argentina and Brazil, for example, and in some other countries. So I think that answers a part about Venezuela. Thank you.
One more question.
More about
About the alcohol fuels program. Well, as you know, Brazil is a world leader in this area. And the interesting thing is that the program went in moments of starting and interruption. In the 70s, the program was attempted, but it didn't go as far as it is going today. Interestingly, in the past 6 years, as I mentioned, the impact has been tremendous in terms of establishment of a national market for ethanol and for flex fuel cars, to the point where 40%, very soon 50% of the entire fleet of cars will be running on will be flex fuel cars, meaning they can either run on ethanol or gas. This, of course, depends on a choice by the consumer, and to a certain degree, it has proceeded at such an accelerated pace. I think to a large degree, even due to the high price of oil internationally. But Brazil has also become self-sufficient in oil production, which is perhaps more surprising even to someone from my generation. I remember as a young kid or teenager in Brazil hearing or reading about or hearing people say that we would never be self-sufficient in oil and that it was useless to even drill. And, well, thanks to some advanced technology for deep water drilling, Brazil is now a producer of oil. That we even export some oil abroad and have managed to attend to our national market. So I think today the program doesn't benefit from any government incentives. It is an extremely profitable industry. Leaders of this industry are in the state of São Paulo, but there are also some producers of sugarcane for ethanol use in the northeast of Brazil, and other regions now are investing in the biodiesel front that actually has an interesting social impact because particularly interesting from the point of view of generating jobs and more labor-intensive and jobs in depressed areas since you can use inputs from castor oil, palm oil, products that grow in the more arid northeast. But the program doesn't really exist as such. There is a strong interest by the private sector. It's become very dynamic, and to the extent that it becomes a world commodity and that more countries around the world become more interested, Brazil is poised to become, I think, a big exporter of ethanol. We would like to see the tariff here in the United States that prevents exports from growing at a faster pace to gradually be eliminated, and this would be our expectation as we work even with the U.S. government itself in promoting the commoditization of ethanol. But we see other markets emerging in Asia, in Europe, and elsewhere, either for ethanol as a fuel on its own or for adding ethanol to gasoline.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.